G'day there, it's Mark Lebusque for the Simply Practically Human podcast, and great guest today who is an expert in human durability, but just as he says, a good human who likes to help other humans, Derek McManus. And Derek's going to share a very personal story of being shot 14 times in a very short period of time when he was part of the STAR group, which is sort of the special operations type police looking after high risk situations, is the one he found himself in at the time, and laid for 3 hours bleeding out, but used a lot of what he calls human durability to not only get through that, but come back to the workplace, but also these days use what he learnt and what he learnt through a lot of the work he did back in the police and other areas like that on how to become more durable and to tap into your durability. So today he will talk a little bit about the difference between resilience and durability and share a whole lot of things about human beings and how human beings could tap more into that durability that they sometimes don't realize they have. And he'll share the ways to do that. And interestingly, but when he's not helping humans, he says he's looking after himself. So he loves riding his bike, getting out 100 Ks on a Saturday morning. He's just started taking dance lessons. He said a bit of ballroom and Latin, and he loves a bit of the cha-cha, a nice waltz, and a bit of salsa just for the fun of it all. And one thing I really learnt from Derek is that he wants to have fun. He wants to continue to do things that make life fun for him. So I think you're really going to enjoy this episode today. So sit back, have a listen, and take down some notes. I'm sure you'll be blown away by his story.
Life can get pretty complicated. In the Simply Practically Human podcast, Mark Lebusque talks to incredible humans to see the way forward more clearly through the complexity in the world and in our heads. Let's get ready to thrive.
I'm a bit of a fanboy today with this one, I've got to say, because my guest today is, I asked him what he wanted to be called. He's not fussed about titles, so here's my go at it. A bloody good human being who spends a hell of a lot of time helping other humans to become, I say, better versions or better humans. So welcome, Derek McManus, to the podcast.
Mark, sensational to be here. And I really do appreciate being introduced that way, because as we had a bit of a discussion, people love titles. I don't. I'm just a bloke who does some stuff and it works for people and I'm happy about it. And that makes me passionate to see the look in people's eyes of, oh, gosh, I get that now. That makes sense to me. I work with fighter pilots, and when I talk to them, they go, does this happen to other people? And I go, yeah, this happens to everybody. He goes, oh, thank goodness for that. I thought it was just me because of all that judgmental. But yeah, thank you for that introduction.
My pleasure. And we'll dig into that as we go, because, you know, what I know about your work is that it's about humans, this stuff. It's not about titles and what sort of work you do, and that this is very relatable to all human beings. I always ask a little bit about how we initially connected, because I'm very big on building that connection before we sort of get into the other stuff. Can you recall? I think it was LinkedIn, wasn't it? We connected via LinkedIn.
I've been following you on LinkedIn for a while, and I saw you were doing podcasts, and I've just gone, I want to be on that podcast. and so this is a bit of a fanboy thing for me as well, back the other way.
Oh, I love that.
Be on that podcast. I love the stuff you do.
Thanks,
mate. So I reached out to you and you've gone, yep, thanks very much. So, yeah.
Yeah, no, it's good to have you on, mate. I think there might have been a connection through that crazy podcast to Craig Harper. I think you might know a little bit about Harps as well.
Yeah, Harps, yeah. and he is a crazy man, isn't he?
He is indeed.
And, roll with the punches. I can't remember her name.
Yeah, Tiffany.
Tiffany. Yeah, she's an amazing kid as well.
Yeah, no, they're doing some good work. Yeah, well, we are getting on a bit, mate. So we're going to get into the topic of durability today and human durability, and your story is fascinating, and then the way you've been able to take that and do the incredible work that you do today, which is relevant to all human beings. So, you know, we talked a little bit just off air before. We had a connection from the fact that I'd lived in Adelaide for a short period of time. You are based in Adelaide, and wanted to kick us off, Derek, with just the backstory, a bit about where you grew up and your interests at a young age, your career choices and your pathway. So let's hear a bit about the Derek McManus story.
Okay, so, real quick overview. Born in Scotland, came out here when I was 3, grew up in Elizabeth Park, right next door to Jimmy Barnes. I like to tell people that. It's not true, but I tell people that and they believe me. And Elizabeth was turning into a bit of a rougher place. So Dad's gone, we need to move. So we moved to Salisbury North, which turned out to be a rougher place, but that doesn't matter. I grew up in Salisbury area, and it really was good upcoming. You know, when we were living in Elizabeth, my brother and I would go wandering off into the hills with a packed lunch, and we'd be disappeared for the day. Kids can't do that or don't do that these days. So for me, my growing up, I was just chasing what made me happy. And that seems to be a theme throughout my life. I didn't do well in high school because I was more interested in going surfing, but I took an interest in joining the police force and got into that. And even my police career, the only thing that I wanted was to end up being someone of significance in the police department, and not for significant sake, but to be a person who was making decisions and taking control and having an influence on other people. And so I always wanted to get into the higher ranks. But other than that, I just went and did what I wanted to do. But there was a point where I started getting bored with the police. I wasn't getting as much satisfaction. And this will tell you how old I am. I was looking through the newspaper at all the job ads. There was no Seek back in my day. to find another job, I was looking outside the police department. And one of my mates suggested that I should go and join Star Group. And Star Group, Special Task and Rescue, high-risk arrest, hostage siege, counter-terrorism, helicopter operations, abseiling, cliff rescues, mine rescues, cave rescues, diving, VIP security. And I've gone, oh, that sounds interesting. I can't think of anything else to do. Let's go and chase that bit of fun. And it became my passion. By chasing my fun, I found my passion. And I absolutely loved it and completely immersed myself in it. But the one thing that I will qualify in that is that the one thing that was always the most important to me was my family.
Yeah.
I was passionate about my work, and I can't do that work unless I'm passionate. But I was more passionate about my family. They were my driving force for everything that I did.
I love it, mate. What couple of great things that come to mind for me there. So the fun aspect, the passion of it. I love how you've brought the family into it. Obviously, in working in such a setting as well, like must be challenging from a family perspective as well, because that's high-risk work that you're working in, yeah?
Yeah, absolutely. So the family's got to be completely on board, and we'll get into how I made sure my family was on board in a minute. But we've got to have our family completely on board and understanding, because we can be in the child's first birthday, 21st birthday, at their wedding, you know, and we get a phone call going, there is a major high-risk event. Yes, we've called everybody else in, but this is so big, you need to leave now. That doesn't happen very often, that it's in a wedding or something like that. But birthdays, dinners, all that sort of stuff, it's not uncommon to get a phone call going, major incident, you need to come in now. And it's just up and gone. And we may be gone for 3 days, we may be gone for a week.
Yeah. And that getting the buy-in from the families, regardless of the work that you're in, whether it's that high-risk work, people can say any sort of work is high-risk, but I think that buy-in from your family is critical. Sometimes, I think in my career, you just take the next promotion or whatever it be, and you say, I'm going to have to do a bit more and work longer hours. But I don't think you were asking for buy-in. You were just making a statement. It was almost an inform rather than a consult piece. And I think what's come to mind for me when you've said that is that power of consulting back into your family about here's what I'm thinking of doing and here's why, because I love it and I'm passionate, but there's going to be some impacts here. And are you signed up for it? So
yeah, absolutely. And it's always got to be two way as well. I mean, they've got to buy in, they've got to be able to support me to do my job. But for them to do that, I need to be having input back into the family. And as I say, my family was number one for me, so that was always easy. When they had something on, I would prioritise it over, you know, other things in my life. I'd give up my basketball. I'd give up my bike riding to go and see the kids do whatever and be with my now ex-wife, you know. Mm. But it takes a two-way street to have that complete buy-in and complete understanding. It's not without its disappointments or its frustrations. But it's part of an open, honest, confronting conversation is what I call it.
Let me circle back quickly for a minute. Yeah. And look, I've never surfed, so I'm not trying to hang out like I'm hanging out with another surfer. But where were your surfing beaches in South Australia? Where'd you go to?
The mid-coast, so down between Port Nalunga and Moana, then down the far south coast, as we call it, down around Victor Harbour, Parsons, Waipinga, Goolwa, down there. Got down to the bottom of the York Peninsula and then did some trips up the East Coast. But, you know, it's a convenient place to go. The surf is not brilliant down on the far south coast, but it's consistent and you can always get a wave.
Mate, I am shit frightened. Having been a boy that grew up on the Murray River in Mildura, I am absolutely shit frightened about going past knee depth into the wide blue ocean because of what might be out there. Did you ever have any encounters with any sea creatures that might have seen you as a meal rather than as some sort of friend?
I was over when I was probably only around about 17. I was over in Port Lincoln and we're out Seal Bay, I think it was. A mate of mine and I were out there surfing and we saw all these people on the beach. And these people, we couldn't hear them. They were miles away from us, but we could see them and they're waving at us. And, you know, being innocent, young, naive kids, we're going, oh, they mustn't see too many surfers out here. So we started waving back and then there was this shadow passed underneath us and we were onto the beach with them as well. So, you know, I've had my encounters, but not as many as other people.
I've
been fairly fortunate.
Yeah, no, I'd say I'll leave that to you, mate. I'd rather swim across from the Mildura side to the Baronga side in Mildura with a big fat carp swimming underneath me than a bloody white pointer shark. So you can have that.
It's all about risk tolerance, you know.
Yes.
We all make assessment as to the risks we take, and this is part of what we'll talk about later. But I don't see myself as a risk taker. I see myself as a risk manager, and I have a look at all those things. Where am I comfortable with taking the risk? That was one of them. There's other stuff that other people go and I go, not a chance, no way in the world will I. So, you know, we all have our risks that we are comfortable with.
Which brings me to a quote off your website from Mandela, which says, you cannot prepare for tomorrow while secretly pretending it won't happen. And it sort of, I guess it brings me into what really fascinated me about you. There's many things, but this one in particular, the incident in 1994. And I haven't really asked you about whether we want to dig into that too much, but mate, every time I read that, I'm like, fucking hell, like I'm still speaking to this guy. But taking that quote and reading a bit more about you, you obviously spent a lot of time thinking about things that could happen and planning for what might happen. Are you happy to talk a bit about that day in 1994? Like shot 14 times, lying there for 3 hours. Yeah, share a bit of that, please. That would be great.
Yeah, the interesting thing about that, shot 14 times, lying there for 3 hours, and I'll go into some more detail in a sec. I got to one point where I lost so much blood that even my vision closed down. The doctor that first got to me said I was only 30 seconds from death. And, you know, it's not traumatic for me to talk about. I absolutely love talking about it, and it's not from a gory point of view. I'm just relaxed about it. But this goes back to buy-in from family. This goes back to open, honest, confronting conversations about reality. And that goes to the Nelson Mandela quote. We can't prepare for tomorrow while secretly pretending it's not going to happen. So 1994, I was a member of Star Group. We went out to arrest a guy in the Barossa Valley. He was designated as high risk because of interactions we'd had with him before. So we knew there was a potential for something to go wrong. He obviously didn't want to be arrested, and he made it very clear that he didn't want to be arrested, because as I went down the side of a house to check out a door to see whether we could make an entry, he started shooting and I was the target. He fired 18 times with a SKK Chinese military rifle. It's the largest common caliber that's used. The bullets fired were the same the Chinese use when they go to war, and he hit me 14 times. With either bullets or shrapnel. And without going through all the injuries, he hit me once in the left forearm, broke the bone in two places, severed the radial artery. A piece of shrapnel lodged in my right wrist. That severed the ulnar artery. I had two bullets into my stomach. I lost 45 centimetres of bowel. I had two bullets hit my left thigh and just missed the femoral artery, according to the doctor, by the width of a piece of paper. One bullet went through my Achilles tendon and took out 80% of the thickness of my Achilles tendon. And even today, I only have 20% of that Achilles tendon. And I describe it that the other bullets were just scrapes and wounds, and they all needed stitches or were major impacts, but they were those that I've described in the major injuries. He fired at me. I got hit. I fell to the ground, and I knew that I needed to fire back at him. But when we're really well prepared, when we've had these conversations about what could happen and we prepare ourselves really well rather than going into denial or going, I'm the lucky one who it won't happen to, or that's too scary to think about, when we really confront it and we prepare ourselves well, we can be relaxed in the midst of adversity. So as I'm lining up to fire back at this shooter, I've fallen onto the ground. I'm on my back. My feet are pointing directly at where I need to shoot. And as I'm lining up, I realize that I'm lying on my back. My feet are at the other end of my body. And when you're lying on your back, your feet point up in the air. And I realize that I need to get up just a little bit so I can shoot over the top of my feet. But I've got a flak vest on, I've got weaponry, I've got equipment. And as I lift my upper body up, my feet come up to counterbalance. And the thought that ran through my head was, I better not shoot myself in the foot because the guys at work will give me shit for the rest of my life. You can just imagine, you get shot 14 times and then you shoot yourself as well. Now, this didn't stop me from doing what I needed to do. But it's like when you're driving a car, your thoughts are off here, your thoughts are off there. But if something happens in front of you, you can respond exactly the way you need to because you're well prepared for it. I prepared for what I could realistically expect to encounter. And what I talk about when I talk to people is, what are their challenges? And as I say, I deal with the RAAF fighter pilots, but I also deal with kids in schools.
Yeah.
I deal with hairdressers. I deal with sparkies. I deal with financial consultants. I deal with banking, lawyers, because everybody has their unique challenges. And we need to just prepare ourselves for what we can realistically expect to encounter. And it really does come down to some very simple processes. And the processes are simple, but depending on the size of the challenge, it's not always easy.
Yeah.
But the process is there. And that's what I talk to people about.
The ability for you to have such clarity, a couple of things you said then, and I know when I was reading about the basis behind this work of human durability, it's taking responsibility is really important. So I picked that up in what you were saying, and I'm sure the listeners will. But this other one about open, honest, and confronting conversations with yourself and with others so that when you get yourself in that situation, you can do something. What amazes me in the workplace, mate, is, you know, we go out and write every 12 months. I say this quite regularly. Every 12 months, we head off to an offsite and write a five-year plan. Every 12 months. Now, yeah. I don't think that when shit hits the fan, let's call it in the workplace, I don't think that the clarity is there as much as it should be because the open, honest, confronting conversations aren't happening and people find it hard to take responsibility. So they'll look outwards and go, well, we didn't hit it because of this rather than what was my part in the mess. So my sense with you is you got such a real clarity about I need to own my part in the mess first and know what I bring to it. And then I need to have conversations with myself and with others so that when I get shot 14 times, I can sit there and be as clear to be able to go, don't shoot yourself in the foot here, mate, because your mates are going to think you're a dickhead. That blows me away that you could do that in that moment.
And what you've just said is so applicable to everybody. And
yeah,
it's the message behind it. We've got to take responsibility for our future. But we go on to these offsites every 12 months and we talk about what the future is going to be and what the challenges are and how we're going to manage it. And everybody talks really openly, excitedly, but there's an elephant in the corner of the room that nobody addresses because it's just too scary.
Yep.
And if we address that and we say we're going to maybe have to deal with that, we won't be able to do what we want. But then when that happens, we're not prepared for it, and that's what destroys a company, that's what destroys a relationship, that's what destroys our future, whatever it might be. And so we've got to actually look at what are the elephants and how do we have those discussions.
And to be able to do that, like, you know, I hear the word, and particularly in these times of what we've been going through, I hear the word resilience a lot. But what I want to unpack now is this human durability piece, this work that you do, because as I've read more of your stuff, I'm like, this is past resilience. We had a bit of a chat before about how there's become a lot of experts in resilience, but talk to me and talk to the listeners about what is human durability? What is and how does one become durable?
Human durability has got resilience. Let me go back a step. Resilience is the ability to bounce back. When something goes wrong, we bounce back from that incident and we work out a problem-solving solution for it and we implement that. But we have to wait for something to happen before we start going through the problem solving. Human durability is about how do we sustain an optimal performance given the challenges that we know that we can face. Now, optimal is not a peak performance. Sometimes it includes peak performance, but sometimes it includes going away and having a massage, going away for a weekend with the kids, taking time out. In fact, I was talking to some CEOs just recently, and one of them was saying, I'm feeling really bad about myself at the moment. I know I'm under stress, so I've had to go to the board and I've had to ask them to take a 2-week sabbatical just to get myself back together. And I've gone, what do you mean you're feeling bad about it? You get 4 weeks holiday every year.
Yep.
And you feel bad about asking for 2 weeks. But this is the essence of durability. He can see that if he keeps on going, he's going to fall over.
Yep.
So he's taking a 2 week sabbatical now. And that's what human durability is. It's about having a look at what are the challenges in the future and how do I best prepare myself to be able to manage them. We can't do that unless we talk about the elephant in the room. And once we start talking about the elephant in the room, it's really, really scary sometimes. But I say there's two levels of comfort that come from it. The first level of comfort is that if I have some anticipation that I could face this challenge and it's really, really scary, then I've got to have a confronting conversation about it. Do I have the skills? Do I have the training? Do I have the support? Do I have the infrastructure? Do I have the team around me? Do I have my family? Do I have the finance? All those things. And the most important thing is, what are the gaps in that? But when we have that conversation, it's really scary, really confronting. But if you actually go, now that I've thought about it, our company can actually handle that. Our relationship can actually handle that. I personally can handle that. Okay, so if I can handle it, let's not go forward tentatively worried about it. Let's go forward bold, courageous. And in that environment, we make better decisions, right? Because we're now relaxed. We're not worried. When we're worried, our decision-making and our creativity narrows. But when we have confidence that we can handle this situation, we relax. Our mind opens up and we see other possibilities. The second level of comfort is when you have a look at it and it's really scary. My God, if we talk about this, I might not be able to do that. And when you look at it and you go, do you know something? It will destroy our relationship, our business, whatever it might be. That level of comfort is, I need to say no and I'd be able to articulate the reason why.
Yep.
It's not just, no, I don't think it's right for me. I'm not really sure. No, you're able to articulate the reason. And when people around you hear you say, I'm not going to do it and this is the reason, that builds confidence in them and trust in you. Trust is a big thing at the moment. But it also gives us the ability to say, I can see where the gaps are. Let's go away and fill those gaps. Let's prepare ourselves better and then come back and do it again. But there's that two levels of comfort. Either I've really got this and let's go forward hard,
yeah,
or I haven't, but here are the reasons why not. And that's one of the most important things.
I just wanted to explore a little bit, if you will, because this is a huge one. Like, what are the elephants you talked about, the elephants in the room? I come across this stuff all the time. It's like, what are we capable of talking about, but we're not prepared to talk about? And there are many of them, mate. Look, people have got many more elephants than they haven't even got a room big enough for all their elephants.
The really obvious one that came out of this shooting is that I had a conversation with my wife 5 years before the shooting when I first joined Star Group. I had a very confronting conversation about the reality that I'm going into Star Group. I eventually became a sniper. I became an underwater recovery diver, and that's very dangerous because going down to deep depths, dark water. But I also trained with the SAS in counterterrorism. So the conversation I had was, I may be shot and injured, I may be shot and killed, right? And if I die, what's your life going to look like? And it was a conversation about her, not just about me, it was about her as well. But the reason that this is one of the elephants in the room is people say to me, oh, well, yeah, police would have those conversations. That's just natural for the police. No, There's only about 1% of cops that actually have that conversation with their partner. Now, it's an elephant in the room because cops carry a gun on their hip. We all know it's possible. And we sort of talk around it, but we don't talk about it and how it would actually affect us. And the conversation I have with my wife is, what happens to you afterwards? And we discussed whether she goes on and gets married afterwards, whether she stays single and looks after the children. And it wasn't about me giving her permission to do these things. It's about me saying to her, whatever you think you need to do, I fully support. You have my absolute support and everything going forward, rather than her thinking, oh, should I go and get married? What would Derek have wanted for me?
Yeah,
would he have wanted somebody looking after his children? So we've had this conversation and it's clear. There's no ambiguity in her mind. The other conversation we had was, if I get shot and I don't die, death is a reality. Anything better than death is going to be a bonus to me. And we had the discussion, I may spend the rest of my life in a wheelchair. It'll be frustrating. It'll be annoying. It'll be difficult. But inside my head, I'll be happy that I made a decision to go into that situation. I knew this was a possibility, so I need to take responsibility for choice, responsibility for the action, responsibility for the consequence, but responsibility for the future afterwards as well.
Mm.
Now, lots of people go, oh, I got hurt and society needs to look after me. I had a lot of help from society.
Yes.
But I had to be the driver. As soon as you sit back and you just go, everybody else take, that's when you become a victim. Yeah. Now, I was a victim of a shooting, but I wasn't a victim of the circumstances. I took control, I drove it, and brought on all the support I could possibly get.
Which is interesting because, you know, reading again more of your backstory, that the doctors and like the psychs and all that, they were just amazed at how you'd worked. I'm not going to say bounce back because that's resilience, how you worked through this. But then 2.5 years later, you were back into full duties, if I'm correct there, yeah?
Yeah, absolutely. I certainly bounced back. I got some major injuries and I had to bounce back from that. But the human durability, the preparing for optimal performance and the challenges, what I said to myself was, once I'd had this conversation with my wife, I went away and had a conversation with myself. I want to perform at the peak. I'm in star group. I always want to be performing at the highest levels. But I know that if I get shot, highest level peak performance is impossible.
Yep.
So if I get shot and I drop to the ground and I've got massive injuries, what can I expect of my performance at that level? And how can I sustain my optimal performance there? Four things that I really clarified for myself. First one, which is what everybody needs to do, is control panic.
Yes.
When panic takes control, the emotions go high, rational thinking goes low. And when our rational thinking is down here, this is fight and flight. This is panic mode. This is not when we do the stuff we've been trained to do. This is when we do the dumb shit, you know, the absolute stupid stuff. So I had to control panic, not let panic control the situation. The second one was knowing that my body was going to respond in a certain way because of shock. And I needed to be able to control that shock. And there are things that I learned through diving, through just being in star group, through the high level of first aid that we are involved in, rescue first aid. I knew that there were certain things that I can do inside my body that could slow down my heart rate and slow down my breathing. And those were the other two. I had to slow down my heart rate so that my heart didn't just panic and go into fibrillation and pump all the blood out. And I had to slow down my breathing. Now, slowing down my breathing was partly about slowing down my heart rate,
yep,
partly about calming my body. But the reading that I've done now about slowing down our breathing and just taking time, it is so, so powerful. I didn't realize it was so powerful at the time, but it's one of the most important things we can do. Just take that moment to take a few deep breaths. Our body relaxes, our mind relaxes, and then we can start thinking broader again. So those four things were key to me being able to survive.
I'm going to hold this one for a minute. I want to come back to the piece of how we walk past stuff and we let it go and, you know, until there's an absolute disaster or something, and then all of a sudden we've got to do something about it. But you talk a little bit about the three C's as well: certainty, confidence, and courage. How are they related in this space of human durability as well?
Well, see, this comes back to having those open, honest conversations and the two levels of comfort. I had taken a look at the challenges. I may be shot and injured, I may be shot and killed, going diving, abseiling, cliff rescue, cave rescue. I've abseiled down 30-story buildings face first, all this sort of stuff. But I had a look at those challenges and I said, do I have the skills, all those things that I said before? And because of the people and the environment around me, I had the comfort and the confidence that everything was in place to give me the best chance, not absolute certainty, not absolute perfection, but the best chance of having an outcome by design. And that gave me the confidence to be courageous and go forwards. And this was about having clarity of that whole situation. And the more we have conversations about it, the clearer we can be.
So let's dive into that now, because I think there's an opportunity to get some. These are really, I always look for like three pretty helpful tools or tips that people can use. And I want to go to this piece on whether or not we're prepared to bring the elephants out or whether we're just going to walk past the elephants. Because look, mate, you would know this. This happens every day at an individual level and at a group level, an organisational level, a community level, a government country level. These things happen all the time. I think what I'm interested to explore a bit here with you is, and looking again at these two elements to the human durability, the open, honest, confronting conversations and taking responsibility, what would be some tips you would give to to an individual or maybe a group or a team that is struggling to look around and see those things that it needs to see but it doesn't want to see, what would you tell them to do?
The first thing they need to do is understand that the conversations don't have to stop them doing anything.
Yep.
It doesn't have to stop them, because that's what we're most scared of. If we talk about that, that will mean that we're not able to do this. And I want to do this. There's some shiny things. There's some exciting things. Love doing it. It doesn't mean you have to stop. Sometimes it's the absolute clarity that, oh, my gosh, I've got more skills than I realized. I can go forward hard. Or actually, that's going to destroy us. So let's go away and build up in this area and come back more confident.
Yep.
So having those conversations empowers us to do things better. Now, we're all scared about making mistakes and being embarrassed. Well, let's have some conversations and do some proper preparation for being able to do it. It's one of the basis of Star Group is that we need to prepare to give ourselves the best chance of success. And the other thing is that we need to allow anybody within the group to ask a question to clarify for themselves that everything is in place. So it doesn't matter whether somebody's been in Star Group for 5 minutes, 5 hours, 5 years, whatever it might be. If we're going into an operation and they are not clear on what's going to happen, or they're worried about some aspect from a safety level, we insist that they put their hand in the air and they say, boss, I'm not sure about this. What are we doing about this? Is this too risky because of this? Now, this could be just 3 minutes before we assault a house and rescue hostages. And we insist that they ask these questions, because if somebody has a question in their mind, then they're going to be distracted on that rather than focused on the task. Mm. There's an old saying that 99% committed is hard and distracted. 100% committed is easy and implementable without question. And the 1% is the thinking out there. So we insist anybody can ask a question. And the two things that we are comfortable about that is that the boss will either say, actually, thank you for the question. I've already thought about it. We've got these things in place. This person goes, oh, excellent, no problems. Let that one go, focus. Or the boss is open enough to say, great question. I hadn't thought of that. This is what we need to do. And so it's that vulnerability as well as having those open conversations. And that just gives you that clarity to move forward positively. And we talk about needing focus. If we're distracted on all those elephants, because those elephants are always with us,
yep.
Even though we don't talk about them, we know they're there. And if we can get rid of the elephants, then we can go forward hard.
Mate, that's such a powerful example, because I'm sure people listening here and who haven't been in the Star Group or anything, but they're in their workplace and they're like, he's just talked about us. He's actually just talked about me at a time when I wanted to ask a question and I didn't ask it. But then 5 minutes later, someone else asked it and everyone thought that they'd split the atom and that they were like a genius, because there's something about us that goes, don't ask a stupid question, particularly if I'm new. And I just want to digress a little bit here, because I know you work with school kids in that as well, which I think's incredible. What are your thoughts around how much more of this teaching people at a younger age about what you're talking about, how critical that is to perhaps change the way we face into issues?
I love talking to anybody, and I love talking to anybody anywhere. But I think if we can get these messages of getting clarity, getting confidence in ourselves, building aspects of comfort in challenge, and making people comfortable that, you know, challenge might be good for one person, but you don't like it, you'll take a challenge in another area that they don't like, understanding ourselves. If we can get those messages into kids early, their lives just open up.
Yep.
Everybody's worried at the moment about kids being protected and being over nursed and being soft and not being resilient. Kids are kids. Yeah. If we can get these messages in early and then allow them to take some chances, moderated and within their ability. But everybody's got to be able to take risk. There is a lot of research at the moment around the dignity of risk.
Yep.
If we take risk away from everybody, they just go, well, if I can't make a choice, then why bother? And they give up. And that's maybe what they're seeing in kids at the moment.
Yeah.
They want to go out there and they want to take risks. We know they do things wrong. We still take risks. And something that I make very clear when I give my presentations, and it's in relation to some fairly graphic photos that I show people at appropriate times, is that I do a lot of risky stuff, and I still do a lot of risky stuff in my life, but I don't see myself as a risk taker. I see myself as a risk manager. And that's what businesses want. That's what people in relationships want. That's what kids going through school want. They want to be risk managers. Depending on the size of the risk, the greater the management. If it's something that's just going to be a little bit embarrassing, it's going to cost you $10, no worries. Great Aussie saying, go and have a crack. No problems. Yep. But the greater the risk, the greater the planning, the greater the management needed.
So there's the kids aspect. And we talked before the recording here about you love it when people just get it. Let's go to the other end of the scale, let's call them the more mature ones, because I think we can always learn, Derek. There's no doubt about it. There must be some real satisfaction for you as well when you may be working with someone who's a bit ancient like me, 54, and you're like, fuck, he's just told me he gets it. So that must feel pretty good for you as well to be able to help people who maybe you've grown up and been institutionalized in a way of thinking. It's all about, I'm not going to take risks, or I'm not going to step into stuff, or I'm going to wait for shit to go bad and then I'll bounce back. How good does it feel when you can help some of us more mature folk to understand this?
It's absolutely exceptional. As I say, I spoke to that fighter pilot, and when he said, oh, that's a relief, I thought it was just me. I know that that just opened up the possibilities for him. He will now go and take more chances and do more things, not take risk per se, but he will go and take more chances to grow. And there's a model that I work with, which I call the continuum of durability, where we get to being 100% reliable, but when we take on the next risk, we've got to be accepting that we're just going to slide back a little bit from 100% reliable to being that learning person again. You can't be the 100 best all the time and always taking on challenge, because you have to be open to learning. And I know that he is now more open to learning because he knows everybody else is doing that as well. But when we talk about talking to people at the higher end, I talk to people who are going into retirement.
Yes.
And people go, oh, they're out of the risky area. There's no risk. Well, no, there's change, there's challenge, and there's risk in that as well. And taking on and being an optimal performer is not always about growing and getting bigger. When we get to that end of life, it's being comfortable that downsizing and downscale is actually a challenge as well. Am I going to do it right? Am I going to go too small? Am I going to become too confined? Am I going to get too frail? All these things. But if we manage them properly, I've seen people at the age of 80 just going, really? Excellent. Now I can go and do. And no matter who I'm talking to, 12-year-old kids in school, Sparkies, retired people, I love it when they just go, oh, that makes sense to me. And I feel better about making choices that other people go, why would you?
Mate, we are so captive to, and look, these stories start from a very bloody young age. And I talk to people about the two filing cabinets we have in our head, the good news and the bad news one. The bad news one is massive. The good news one, not so big. But the amount of people that say to do come in a room with me too, and they're like, you can almost see it. And then they say, what's like what? And they go, I've just realized it's just not me. Like, I'm in a room with someone from a different industry with a different title with different years of experience who have the same stories about why they can't work through something because it's them. And I just think this is a really critical message to get out to the world, is that start maybe hanging around a few people that aren't like you, as in title, industry. And then what you're going to find is that, you know, the elite sports guy who you've seen as a hero and all this sort of stuff is going through the same shit as the Sparky or the kid at school.
Absolutely. I've got a mate now, Patrick Yonker. He was 5 times Tour de France, won many of the national competitions and all that sort of stuff. And he's gone, every elite athlete needs to do the workshop that I was doing. But I've also got teachers going, my 12-year-olds, how often can you come to the school?
Yep.
The message is the same for just about anybody.
I love it when I see someone writes about replacing things with simplicity. You've got stability, clarity, and control. I'm particularly, this is a very selfish one for me now because I call it the Simply Practically Human podcast. Why is it, do you think, that humans, and if you do think this, because you may have a different view, I have a view that humans are romanced by the flame of complexity or complicated. They like to create that situation and even sometimes create the burning, what do they call it, the old platform, the burning platform for change, and then it all becomes complicated. Is there a reason why humans don't step towards simplicity in the simple stuff, do you think?
I'm talking off the top of my head here. I've done no research into it, but what crystallizes for me out of that is that we have such respect for institutions of learning, the universities, the professors, the educators, the teachers. We've got such respect for them that we believe that our thinking isn't complex enough. We haven't had enough education, so I don't have the ability to talk about it. And if I want to do something, then I'm just, and this goes back to, I have six steps for resilience, building our own resilience, and it's building self-esteem. The first one is silence the inner critic.
Yep.
Like that voice inside your head, those filing cabinets, because that voice inside our head is going, I'm not smart enough, so I need to go and talk to someone who's done a research assignment in this. I need someone who's written a book about this, because they're the gurus. And we have this romance that unless I can talk about it at the highest levels, then nobody will respect me. I mean, we need to have an understanding of things, but then we need to talk about it in everyday terms and make it relatable to everybody, not just at the highest levels. So we've got this respect for those in the highest levels, and we believe we need to live up to it. And when we want to make decisions for ourselves, we don't feel we have the confidence to do it. And we go,
yep,
I've actually got to go and talk to Mark. Mark knows all this stuff. He's got to give me the advice. I can't make the decision. And the final thing I'll say about that is that I honestly believe that everybody right now has the ability to take on the next challenge that they want to. It may not be the massive challenge, but it's the next step in getting to that challenge. And once we take that next step, and that next step may be just going and doing a Google search. It might be going getting a book from the library. It might be going talking to someone, enrolling in a course. Just enrolling in a course is the next step. But that builds momentum, and then we keep on going, and that will build the next skill, and we just keep on going from there.
Jeez, mate, I love that you have just opened, as Harps would say, you've just opened a big door here, because one thing that I tend to see happen is that people look for the big, massive challenge.
Yep.
And it's like, let's set they call it the BHAG, the big, hairy, audacious goal. And it's like, well, I love what you've just said. Now, a challenge can be Googling something up. A challenge can be this, what we're doing right now. Even though I've done 90 of these, it's like, how big do I want to make this? Because I'm a fanboy. Was the heart rate a little higher before today? Maybe so than some other ones. But looking at it across a whole perspective line, how big is that challenge compared to something else? Why is it we want to set the big one?
Well, I think we see everybody else and they're achieving all those BHAGs, right?
Yeah.
And we go, oh, my gosh, I can't do that. But to get to that BHAG, we have no idea what they've compromised, what concessions they've made, how many tears they've had at a nighttime, how many sleepless nights, just the same as us.
Yep.
I talk about my recovery from the shooting started when I was in hospital and I had all sorts of assistants. I had doctors, nurses, physios, all helping me to work. But I had bandages on every limb of my body, stitches in my torso. And when I first started trying to do things, I could do the major motor skills, but I couldn't do the fine motor skills. And at one point, I started being able to move my little finger. And this for me was, okay, great. I've been trying to do something in my fine motor skills. This is sensational. And people were coming into hospital and going, look, I can move my little finger. They were looking for the big changes.
Yep.
I was excited about the little finger, and this comes down to those six steps to resilience. We've got to celebrate the little things.
Yes.
Now, people go, that's a cliche. That's just a throwaway line. Yeah, everybody says that, but let's get serious. What are we doing? No, this little finger being able to move, once I was able to do that and repeat that and repeat that, it then brought on the next finger. This was the sign that I had started recovering.
Yes.
If we take that first step to go and do a Google, that's the first sign that we are advancing towards that BHAG, but nobody will see you doing the Google search. Nobody will see you doing the enrolling. Nobody will see you staying up later at night and just reading a book. Nobody sees that. That's got to be something inside of us
that
we celebrate for ourselves.
I love it. There was one other thing you said before, and I've got to come back to it. You talk about how we sing about that intellectual competition as such, is we don't know as much as the professors. And look, I'm more of a heart and gut guy than a head guy. But the thing that's important to me now is that I do read some research and these sorts of things. But One question that I want to put to people that are listening, and I'm interested in your thoughts. At times, I think we hide behind research, and like I say to people, "Well, what do you think?" And then they'll start to, and then they'll go, "Well, yeah, but I read this research paper by Derek, and so this must be the answer." I'm like, "Well, what do you think?" And do you think we've lost the art of thinking a little bit there as well, as in holding our own thought or perspective or opinion on it?
Yeah, this goes back to those two filing cabinets in your head, that inner critic. I'm not smart enough. I've got to go and talk to somebody who's smarter than me before I'm able to do anything. And, you know, going back to the shooting and what I did in the shooting, I had my own way of thinking and I just thought through these things. I had that conversation with my wife. A lot of people say, well, how did you know to do that? Well, I just felt it was the right thing to do.
Yep.
So this is going back to your heart and gut. How did I know to control shock, control panic, slow down my heart rate, slow down my breathing and be able to implement it? Well, I just thought that's what everybody would want to do when they've taken on these challenges. And everybody in Star Group, I had one of the guys in Staries come to me and say, Derek, I've spoken to several people and nobody would have responded the way you did. And why did you do that? It was intuitive. I believed that this is what I needed to do. And intuitively, I trusted myself. Outside, you know, when I was talking to other people, I doubted myself. Oh, I couldn't tell you about this. But when it was about me, I just did what I thought was intuitive. And to be quite honest, I described the shooting as I went to work, I got shot, I fell down, I got up, I got better, I went back to work. Yep. Because for me, that's all it was.
Yep.
I knew there were risks. I prepared for them. I managed to get over them and I wanted to go back to work. It's like getting back on the horse that throws you. That was just part of the process. But we need to trust ourselves more.
Yes. Here's one without notice, but I reckon my sense after 50-odd minutes is you're up for the challenge.
Love it. Bring it on.
Where does curiosity play into this human durability, the ability for us to be curious about things?
Absolutely essential, absolutely vital, because curiosity is not investigating. It's not researching. It's not intellectual. It's just, oh, I've got an interest. Let's go and have a look at this. And we're allowed to do that. But that curiosity will take you to your passion, will take you to what you find you get the most reward. And we just need to be curious. If there's something in our minds, let's just go and ask a question. And it doesn't have to be, I want to become an expert on it. And I'm just going to ask. People get really frustrated with me. Derek, how could you ask that question? Because I was curious.
Yeah.
And most people quite enjoy it. But curiosity is essential. It's the basis to everything. What you are curious about, if you make that inquiry and you find it really sparks you, that's what you'll go on and you'll become an expert in or become really knowledgeable in it and just delve into it.
I often wonder why, and when I ask this question of people, imagine if you, or just a statement, imagine if you, instead of thinking it was a difficult confrontational, conflictual conversation, what if you went in there thinking it was a curious conversation, what would happen? And I actually think we need to embrace curiosity first in ourselves. Like it all starts with self. So we've got to embrace that. So then we can be curious. I'm curious to know more about me. Then I'm curious to know more about maybe what others think about me, but then what I can work out and learn from them as well. So I think curiosity is a big piece.
I'm just going to pick up on that curiosity because it's something else that crystallized for me. Is sometimes we restrict ourselves from being curious because we're worried about how other people would judge us.
Yep.
Now, this is just something that I'm interested in. Nobody else will be interested in it, so I'm just going to stay quiet about it. People will think I'm an idiot if I ask that curious question because everybody else seems to know the answer, so I'm not going to. But we've just got to allow ourselves. One of the other things I say to people is that sometimes when you ask that curious question, other people in the room will be going, thank goodness someone asked it because I wanted to. But there are so many people thinking the same thing as we do, but because nobody else is talking about it, it becomes the elephant in the corner of the room and nobody talks about it.
And we end up digging ourselves back into our bad news filing cabinet. All of those things, I don't want to look stupid. You will look stupid because you did it one other time and everyone said you should know the answer. So I love how you brought that in. Where can the listeners connect with you, find out more about what you offer? I also know you're doing some work with, is it the Uni of South Australia? Is that right as well?
Yeah, University of South Australia School of Psychology. They're giving me uni students as part of their development to help me research human durability. I work with Military and Emergency Services Health Australia. They support our veterans coming back from war, as well as the emergency services who are dealing with PTSD, anxiety, depression.
Yep.
And they're getting me into work with those guys as well, because this model is just very different to what's out there at the moment. So obviously I've got a website. I am just about to run 4 public courses. I rarely run public courses, but if you link up with me on LinkedIn or Facebook, I'll be marketing on there. It'll also be on Eventbrite, so follow me on Eventbrite as well. They are going to be in South Australia, but I'm also going to have virtual as well. So they're going to be hybrid events. So hopefully, you know, anybody from around the world will just be able to come in and watch. And I will be interacting with those people online. And that's something that I love. You know, it can't just be sit in the corner. You will be asked to do a few things as well.
Yeah, no, we can't. No one should ever turn up to one of those things thinking that I've got 2 hours off from my life, or I've got 2 days off or whatever. When you get in the room, I think what you put in the room is what you get out of it. Mate, I just wanted to say thanks again. This has been a fascinating conversation. The ability for you to share such a story. And as you said, I'm very happy to share that story because I know what it does. It's going to help others to become better humans. So thanks for coming on, mate.
Mate, it's been a pleasure. Absolute pleasure. Thank you. As I say, I've been watching you for ages, listening to your other podcasts. And I just wanted to be part of this discussion because I knew, and you've delved down into places where I haven't gone before. And now I've got other places to be curious about and go and find out some more information. So I love it.
I'm not quite sure where to start after that conversation with Derek, because he went in so many directions. But I guess starting with this idea of the difference between resilience and durability, while both are important, that resilience is bouncing back, sort of that problem solving, and Derek talked about waiting for something to happen and then bouncing back from it, whereas the durability piece was about stepping into it. Those two particular things he talked about in regards to building human durability is, first of all, having open, honest and confronting conversations with yourself first and then with others. And he used a great example of his conversation with his ex-wife at the time about going into the STAR group and the risks that he would take, and then taking responsibility for that. And, you know, that particular day in 1994 when he took his responsibility, because he'd had the conversations with himself to get really clear about what he needed to do. Fascinating to hear those sorts of things. Love to share about simplicity and complicated and complexity, this idea of our respect for the institutions of learning and feeling like we're not learned enough or intelligent or intellectual enough, and that maybe we've got to stop thinking about that and start thinking about it in a bit of a different way. That what if we are? What if we didn't need to go off to uni or get an MBA to have an opinion, to have a thought, to share our curiosity with others, ask questions, do those sorts of things? You know, the work that he does, he's such a passionate human being for helping everyone from school kids. And, you know, he said right through to the work he's doing today with returned servicemen and helping him with the PTSD stuff. Just was an incredible conversation, which I hope you've all got something to take away from that. And the biggest message from me, from Derek, is that it was all about that, hey, other people are like me. Whether I'm an Air Force fighter pilot or I'm a 15-year-old school kid, I have these stories, and other people have got stories going on as well. So getting it, or like the 80-year-old he talked about, I get it now, I can get on with it. Hey, get those thumbs a tapping, and if you love this one, please rate it 5 stars and leave us a review would be fantastic. And if you liked it, share it with your friends. But until next time, keep it simple, keep it practical, and keep it human. Bye for now.